We're talking now with Dr. Glenn Tonger from Kansas State University. Dr. Tonger, I'm sure you're going to be looking a little bit backwards, but then also forwards with these guys today at the AFBF. But 2014, one of those incredible years for the cattle industry. About everything that you could have wanted was just about there, it seemed like.
Yeah, one for the record books. And it's easy to give the message that I'm going to give today because 2015 looks pretty good, too. I'm probably going to take the edge off of 2014 a little bit when I talk about 2015. But a lot of what I'm talking about today is highlighting exactly what cow-calf producers that sold something in 2014 know, and as they sold cattle for prices they've never dreamed of before, right, and therefore they had a record year. The good story is I think that's here to stay for a couple of years. I want to highlight and belabor, for those that have heard me before, the importance of meat demand. Going forward, as we take the edge off the tight supply story, it's going to be even more important we understand the role of beef demand. And it's important when we look at 2014 to recognize it's both tight supply and strong demand that gave us those record-level prices. But to sum up my points, it's a very good time to be in the cattle business.
Beef demand, truly, you do some regular studies and you do the calculations on an ongoing basis, but it just seemed like consumers never really backed away.
Yeah, so myself and others would have expected, not necessarily the consumer to back away, but the ceiling on the price is sometimes how it's described to have occurred earlier. And I hate the term ceiling on prices because I believe in sloped demand curves. But the point is, we thought the public would have traded down to other products more than they did. And that's a very positive thing for the beef industry, is there's more loyalty, there's more value seen in those products. And quite frankly, the public's been willing to open up their wallet more than we anticipated. It's important everybody to recognize we know there's fewer beef pounds offered. What we didn't know going through 2014 was what kind of price would they, you know, would those beef pounds realize. Right. And at the end of the day, they were much higher prices than we expected. That needs to continue through 2015, 2016, and forward to maintain profitability in the industry. I am more bullish than a lot of analysts on demand in general, but it's kind of my job here to highlight that's very important, is, you know, the strength of beef demand tells us consumer valuation of beef products. We have to understand that. We have to open and be adjusting that over time. Generational changes, foreign customers want something different, domestic customers. There's a lot we could talk about there. Right. But in aggregate from where you started, beef demand was very good in 2014. We can't lose sight of that.
Now, for 15. It seems like we're going to have a lot more pounds, potentially, of pork and poultry. That'll really test that theory, right?
Well, yeah, we will have more competing pounds out there, and we're probably 3 years away from having more beef consumption per person in the U.S. So, you know, we have a couple more years of, if you like, kind of guaranteed loss of market share, the way you look at that, you know, the retail level for beef. Mm-hmm. What I try to highlight is, A, we don't know exactly how much substitution price sensitivity there is across meats. There's some studies that say that's actually dwindling over time. People form habits. They're less willing to go and substitute a pork roast for a beef roast than maybe once they were, those kind of things. And I think that lends itself well for whether it's beef or pork or chicken. They're less affected by competing meats. But nonetheless, I'm a realist, right? You have more pounds coming from a competing source. It's going to show up, and it's going to put the, I won't say put the test, but it's going to be even more important that the beef industry monitor those changes mm-hmm. and be responsive to consumers, not just in 2015, but here we are sitting in the first part of 2015.
Right. One other area regarding beef demand right now, as far as on kind of a short-term basis anyway, I guess the question is how long this lasts, but we've seen a significant drop in gasoline prices, and that's one of those things the consumer has to pull out of their wallet every time that they fill up. They've got more dollars in their pocket as a result. Is that going to help meat demand, you think?
Yeah, regardless, it's a mixed bag, right? And like all good economists, I give you a long answer to that. But all meat products are what we call normal goods. And as their incomes go up, or in this case, disposable incomes go up because fuel costs or energy more generally are going down, we expect the public to buy more of a product. Short term, they can't do that because we only have so many pounds to offer, right? But going forward, we expect that to show up in the form of higher prices, basically. That definitely has already helped the entire protein complex. It's a reason to be kind of bullish on the demand front and many fronts there because U.S. consumer disposable income's up. But I always mitigate it just a little bit because some of our key exporting partners, such as Russia and some others that are more dependent upon oil income, are likely to import fewer protein pounds because of the hit it is to their economy. In aggregate, I think it's a bullish thing. As we reduce the cost of being in any kind of business, which is what happens when you have oil prices go down, in aggregate, consumer incomes go up, and I think it'll be, you know, more protein demand. But it's going to be a mixed bag. We're probably going to export less. I'll use the Russia example to them, maybe to another country that's less oil dependent, some of those pounds will go there, but domestically it's going to be a very strong thing.
Cow-calf end of the business, one of the big question marks right now, how many cows, how many heifers have we actually got into the cow herd this last year? I guess we'll get a feeling of that later this month from USDA.
Yeah, so my general answer to that is we've had some mixed signals on whether or not we'd expanded. I think we've expanded. The one mixed signal was the July cattle inventory report that was a negative on heifer retention, as you alluded to. Here at the end of January, we'll get NASA's updated estimate of that. I fully expect there to be a year-over-year increase in heifer retention number there. Time will tell if that's confirmed. But it's also important to recognize we can look at quarterly information in the cattle on feed reports to get some sense of what share of the calf crop is staying on the ranch in the form of heifers versus the steers coming to the yards. And per that signal, I think we continue to get more and more confirmation that expansion is underway. The deeper question is how fast can it occur, right? So some of what I'm going to talk about today is a 10-year projection by USDA. Mm-hmm. The punchline of that is over the next 10 years, USDA is saying we might add 15 or 16% to the cow herd. So it gives some sense of expansion long-term for the industry. For those that are good at math, that still keeps us below the 40 million cows we had back in the 70s, mm-hmm. but it's a lot more cows than we have today, and it'll take several years to get there.
So do you feel that's pretty accurate as far as USDA's number?
I probably expect more expansion than some of my colleagues, and maybe that's the reason you're asking. And my best reasoning for that would be is cow-calf producers are like a lot of other producers. They have a dollar in the wallet. They want to spend $1.10, right? And if you think through what I just said for a moment, 2014 was good. I think 2015 is going to be good. I fully expect the typical person that has any remote interest in expansion to plow that money back into the business. Mm-hmm. So if somebody thinks we should add 2 million cows, I would encourage you to think it might be 3 because 2 is what we should, and we'll go too far, right? The pendulum goes too far because we bid it away. If you think it should be 3 or 4, we'll add 5. That kind of notion, I tend to think every number you have in your head, you ought to add 1 million cows because we're going to bid away those returns. Any kind of commodity business, which is what the typical cow-calf producer is in, tends to do that over time. And therefore, I actually think those estimates from USDA might well be realized. What is harder to say is, will we have that expansion in 3 or 4 years, or will it take 4 or 6? That gets into timing. It's weather-related. You know, I kind of hesitate from getting into that micro-forecast points.
We saw these feeder cattle prices get on the ag futures side of things go, just they've really gone crazy the last really since mid-December. It seems like we saw those sharp downs, hard downs, had some sharp, you know, swings back up and whatnot, but we're having a lot more volatility. Is that we're going to just have that for a while?
The easy answer is yes, right, because I think our recent observations are yes. I think we all have to remember there's just more money on the table, period, right? Those animals are worth more, mm-hmm. and when you have, you know, limit, which is what CME had, the ability to find the true price with a fixed dollar per head limit is harder when things are worth more, right? So that is, you know, in the short term kind of magnified the response of volatility there. You also have, we haven't talked about feedlot returns, but something I'm concerned about for 2015 is projections are actually in the red when we look at March and beyond for closeouts. You have to recognize that if you believe those, there's going to be some pushback on feeder cattle values. I'm not worried about the floor falling out there, but that is going to have some pushback on those tight supplies. And you have that give and take all the time that probably we observed starting in the middle of December was some pushback from feed yards that led into some of that volatility as well. That's probably here to stay for 2015.
For feedlots, we've got obviously tight supplies. That means that excess inventory, whether you're talking about feedlots or even into the processing plants, is the industry going to have to still do some readjusting to account for all of that?
Yeah, we have excess. I use the term capacity. We have too many concrete bunks at the feed yard industry and too many hooks for the meatpacking beef processing level specifically. Yes, I think we have more mothballing to come. That's not a very optimistic thing to share. Mm-hmm. But the reality is we have too much capacity there that squeezes margins. And in some sense, somebody in each of those segments is going to be squeezed out. The unfortunate thing is it's got to get worse before it gets better. If, in fact, we're holding heifers out of the system, that throughput problem is going to get worse in 2015, maybe 2016, because there's heifers staying at home on the ranch that aren't coming through the feed yards and so forth. Mm-hmm. That may be the last straw for some, maybe Southern Plains plants we could talk about, maybe Southern Plains feed yards. And I only say Southern Plains because local availability supplies, regionality compared to Mexico, all those kind of things make it a little bit worse there than, say, in Nebraska. There's a reason I always add that component to that. But in aggregate, we probably are going to have a little bit of downsizing of those segments in the industry in the next 2 years.
One other area you kind of alluded to the Mexican cattle here in the Southern Great Plains, country of origin labeling continues to be that proverbial political football. Are we going to finally get this thing maybe resolved this year in the WTO?
I refuse to give timeline projections on that issue. Most issues have a long life, and this is no different. You know, there's over a decade of debate on country of origin labeling. We are to the point where the U.S. has appealed the second ruling for WTO. If the process plays out, you would like to think we're towards the end of whatever the end game of this is. But some of my predecessors, their analysts in this, have been saying that for, 6, 10 years. So I don't want to kind of give false hope to that. The message has been pretty clear from WTO multiple times that it's not trade compliant. There's a growing, I would call it, groundswell of pushback against Kuhl within production ag domestically. I think there's political pressure to change something with it. But in terms of timelines, I have learned a lesson, and I will not make any predictions on timelines because this could go on for a lot longer than a rational mind like me might expect it to.
And K-State has done studies that shows that really there's not a lot of value back to the industry on those little labels.
Yeah, if I could distill it, and this information's on our Ag Manager website, is there's cost, obviously, to comply with it. So you got to offset that with some kind of benefit. And we talk benefits in terms of meat demand benefit. That's what the advocates of Kuhl have said is there. The studies we've done, and there's multiple renditions of it, and you've noted that in different releases you've done, is there's no evidence of a meat demand bump that's come with Kuhl, whether it's the 2009 or the 2013 versions, if you like. And the core reason for that, I would argue, is the public's not aware that there's origin labeling, and there wasn't a lot of voluntary labeling to start with. And as a free market economist, I would sit here and assert that if it was really valuable, we would have had more free market voluntary differentiation of products to start with. In the absence of it, that should have been pretty telling. It's a long way of saying more cost, no observed demand benefit, net loss.